Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action. That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today. The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Samantha Schroeder, Deputy Director of FedSoc Films. Today's episode is inspired by our film, Madison and the Fight for the Constitution, a short documentary that explores how James Madison wrote a new nation into existence and unified the people behind ideals that would change the course of history. Here today to discuss James Madison and his influence on the American founding is one of the stars of our film, David Forte, Professor of Law at Cleveland Marshall College of Law at Cleveland State University. Welcome to the show, Professor Forte.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
I'd like to open with a clip from our film, Madison and the Fight for the Constitution. Take a listen.
The Federalists could not say, you know, you're right, we could have done a better job. Let's go back to the drawing boards. They had gone through 3 months of compromises. If they had opened that box again, there wouldn't have been a Constitution. They had to defend it as it was. They had to say, take it or leave it. In convention after convention among the states, the demand was there should be a Bill of Rights.
So how could someone like James Madison become famous?
He never wanted to be famous. He wanted to be influential. You know, all of us, in some ways, want to be recognized by others. And many of the founders wanted to be recognized by others. You know, there's a name for it for people who search for that all their lives. It's called vainglory. And it's something the opposite of humility. I mean, think of Alexander Hamilton or Benjamin Franklin, who wanted to be the rustic American scientist in Paris, or John Adams, whose vanity made him rage at all his opponents, or Thomas Jefferson, who often acted behind the scenes so he could not be seen as being manipulative. George Washington was the one man who attempted to form his own iconography about himself. For the purpose of being a symbol to the country, he actually lived the famous icon that he came to be, and he succeeded in doing that. James Madison was cut from a different cloth. He had none of the makings of what would become a famous person. Physically speaking, he was diminutive, less than 5'6". He was less than 100 pounds. Or just about 100 pounds. He dressed for some strange reason, almost always in black, and he didn't speak very dramatically. He wasn't known as a great orator. And yet this man, who sought only to become influential, is in some ways the most famous of the founders in this. I've read that there are more cities and towns in this country named Madison than even Washington. He is the most honored in that regard of the founders and the one who least sought honor. He always put forward those who could win the argument by their fame, by Washington, by Jefferson, while he created the background for which the fame could be deserved. Let's take, for example, what he did in formulating his own thinking. He was educated at the College of New Jersey. He went through that college in 2 years. He stayed a year later to specialize under John Witherspoon, who introduced him to all the great thinkers of the Scottish Enlightenment. He then was an ally of Alexander Hamilton in the Confederation Congress in the 1780s and gained great wisdom from his relationship with Hamilton, long before, of course, their falling out. And then when he became friends with Jefferson, they worked together in the Virginia legislature to pass the statute on religious liberty. And when Jefferson was then dispatched to Paris to be an ambassador, Jefferson sent Madison a trunkload of books on ancient history and ancient philosophy, which Madison devoured. Madison, it seems to me, went through a period in the 1780s of what we would call discernment. He was attempting to decide what you and I might call his vocation would be. It was not going to be to win elections in order to become famous. It was to win elections in order to do something. And what was the something I found that he wanted to do? I think it's absolutely clear. He wanted to secure freedom and republicanism in a structure that would be enduring. He set himself that goal in the 1780s. In the Confederation Congress, for example, he saw what everyone else saw, that we couldn't even pay the interest on our foreign debt. The bankers of Holland were the ones who banked every war, and you needed to be able to pay the interest on those debts to be able to fight the next war, and everyone knew there would always be a next war. So Madison suggested, while he was in the Confederation Congress, that at least Congress and the states could pass a 25-year tax to try to right the books. That needed unanimity to pass, and of course it didn't come to pass. It didn't come to be. So then he saw Washington call a conference in Mount Vernon to decide some problems between Maryland and Virginia over the Potomac. Madison was actually named as a delegate to that conference, but didn't receive information about it until the conference was about ended, so he never attended. But that conference in Washington's Mount Vernon showed that much more needed to be done to correct the economic dislocations in the country. We have to remember that the country was just getting through a depression in the 1780s, having gone right after the Peace of Paris. There were rebellions in the states. There were tariffs destroying each other's economies. Spain and England were still attempting to wean away western portions of the country back to their empires. It was a difficult time. And so he put himself to the task of trying to gain a union that would last, but based on the ideas of freedom and republicanism. So what did he do? He called a conference, got the Virginia State Legislature to call a conference in Annapolis in 1786 to try to fix the economic dysfunctions of the Confederation. It was a bust. A few delegates arrived with desultory attitudes. Even Maryland didn't send delegates, even the conference was held in Annapolis. Hamilton was there, of course, from New York. So Madison and Franklin and Hamilton took counsel, and they decided this is going nowhere. Let's up the ante. And so they got the delegates at the Annapolis Convention to issue a call to a larger convention in Philadelphia, where, well, you know that place in the Philadelphia State House where the Declaration of Independence was signed? That'd be a good place. So they decided to hold it there. What a staging. What a place to think of to hold a new convention. And then they got the delegates to say the new convention would meet to decide upon measures to address, quote, the exigencies of the Union, end quote, which meant they could form anything they wanted. Now, the next thing he had to do was to make sure that the states would attend this. They didn't attend at Annapolis. So he went back to Virginia, to the Virginia State Legislature, convinced the legislature to issue a call to send delegates to this conference on the basis of the Annapolis call. All right, now what delegates would be sent? Madison proposed a list, the head of which was George Washington. Now, in those days, one did not get an office. One was not asked whether one wanted an office and then said yes or no. One was given an office and then the mail arrived, and then you decided whether you wanted it or not. So Washington was put on the list without his knowledge or permission. Madison knew that for this convention to be successful, Washington had to be on the list. Now, he had to convince Washington to attend. So he journeyed over to Mount Vernon and spent long hours there, long letters to Washington. Washington was very, very ambivalent about this. The war had just ended in 1783, and this is 1786. He'd only been at his beloved Mount Vernon for 3 years. And he knew if he were called to this convention, the convention would be laid upon his shoulders, one way or the other. If it were successful, it would redound to his image, which he thought was valuable for the country. If it were not, it would redound against his image. Madison won. Washington would attend. With Washington attending, the other states, all except Rhode Island, fell into line and sent their delegates. So now, what else did he have to do? Well, then he hightails it back to New York, to the Confederation Congress, because he knows that this new convention is going to put the Confederation Congress out of business if it's successful. So he needs the approval of the Confederation Congress. It's best to have no institutional enemy. Imagine that. Defanging a possible institutional enemy so there's no real opposition to what the convention can do. Well, the Confederation Congress did agree to the convention, but said it should be held for the sole purpose of amending the Articles of Confederation. And this leads to the long disputed question about whether the delegates exceeded their charge when they met in the convention and decided upon a new government. And that charge is really empty, and I'll digress here to tell you why it was empty. Forrest MacDonald has shown this. Most of the delegates who came to the convention came under the Annapolis Charge, which is to decide on measures to meet the exigencies of the Union. Only four came with the Confederation Charge, which is to amend the Articles of Confederation. In any event, at the end of the convention, the Constitution went to the Confederation Congress, and even if the convention delegates had exceeded their charge, the Confederation Congress affirmed it. And as we know from agency law, if an agent exceeds the directions of his principal and the principal later ratifies what the agent does is then legally binding. So there's no legal problem with what happened there. But he still had everybody online. And so now you can see that Madison was indeed the stage manager of our Constitutional Convention. The theater was booked. The stage was set. The run, beginning in May, was scheduled. And the primary actors engaged, including the star, George Washington. It was now time for the script. With Madison as the main influence, the Virginians arrived at the convention with a plan in hand. The Confederation Congress agreed, and even though the Virginia plan called for an entirely new government, the Confederation Congress would eventually accede to that. The Virginia plan had a division of powers, a dual legislature, both popularly elected, the power to tax, the power to legislate on all matters in which the states were legally incompetent, and the power to veto state laws. Many of these elements were then jettisoned in the debates that succeeded, but something better came out. What came out better was that the states, instead of being opponents to the new Constitution, were integrated into the new government structure. The states would decide who would be senators. The states would decide who would be electors. The states would decide who would be legitimate voters for members of Congress. And so the Constitution was successfully completed in September of 1787. Now, what else did James Madison have to do? Back to New York again. To have the Confederation Congress approve the Constitution without amendments. There he did.
That's so interesting. So you said earlier that Madison was aesthetically, not very intimidating, or, you know, he lacked in stage presence. Was Madison self-aware of this? And did he do anything by way of personality or, you know, habit or acquired behaviors to try to work against himself in terms of developing a better presence?
Not that I know of in all that I've read about him. What he did was he discerned what his strengths were. He had rational capacities far beyond average. He had a dedication to a particular goal. He had the ability to work with other men who were in the limelight, and to gain their assent to propositions he put forward. He was able, in a political way, to make coalitions. He showed that after he became the leader of Congress, actually, in the first Congress, in a sort of his second life as a founding father. Now, James Madison seemed to have an appreciation of his weaknesses and didn't let them bother him, because he also appreciated his strengths and spent more time developing and effectuating policies that derived from his strengths rather than worrying about his weaknesses.
How did Madison's stage presence compare to his fellow founders?
He was always present, always influential. For some reason, I think it was the power of his thinking. People listened to him. Let me tell you what happened right after the convention. While he was in New York, persuading the Confederation Congress to approve the Constitution in the sense of sending it to the states to be ratified by the people, he got a phone call, let's say, from Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton was formulating essays to try to persuade the upcoming New York election for delegates to the New York Convention, try to persuade whoever those delegates would be to vote for the Constitution. And he began a series of essays, which of course later became known as the Federalist, or sometimes the Federalist Papers. John Jay helped him, but then he became ill and couldn't do more than two or three at the beginning. Gouverneur Morris, who wrote the most magnificent beginning of the Constitution in the preamble, was known as a gifted pen, was too busy and uninterested. So he said to Madison, they said, "Can you help us out on this?" They're both in New York. And Madison said, sure. Now, Madison came in. The first essay he wrote was at Madison's famous number 10, perhaps the most famous, one of the most famous political theory essays of all time. He must have had this already set because he came in. It was a total, complete, coherent, insightful argument that lasts until this day with its influence and its perspicacity about political structures. And then he wrote many others as the weeks went by. But he received a pleading letter from his hero, George Washington, who said, turning the year into 1788 when the Virginia Convention was meeting, "Please get down here to Virginia. We need you in the convention." Washington knew and Madison knew that a majority of the delegates elected to Virginia were anti-Federalists, and the Virginia ratification was in doubt. So back down to Virginia he went. And there he and his colleague John Marshall, younger, took on Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry, the most famous rhetorician, orator, among the entire founding generation, was dead set against the Constitution. And every day, practically, Patrick Henry stood up and made another long oration against the Constitution. And Madison just quietly met every point with his manner of quiet speaking, turned aside every argument, and in the end, it was helped by the fact that New Hampshire had ratified the Constitution and became the ninth state, so the Constitution went into effect. And it was helped by the fact that Madison and the other Federalists agreed to promise a Bill of Rights, so long as it wasn't a condition for ratification of the Constitution. The Constitution was ratified by the Virginia delegation with a 10-vote margin.
So what lessons can Madison's unlikely fame teach us about seeking influence?
Well, let's start with Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln gave one of his most famous addresses right after Madison died. Madison, the weakest physically, perhaps, of the founders, was the last to pass away. And only then his notes became public of the Constitutional Convention. And Abraham Lincoln pondered whether, with the framers gone, the country could survive without their physical example being present. Could we continue to adhere to the Constitution? It pained him, and he considered that. And he said, let every mother whisper to her child to obey the laws, that the Constitution must be held to be sacred. Again, this is my paraphrase. So the effect that Madison had wasn't just on, whoa, what a great man he was during his time. No. What battles did he win? No, the effect was in creating a document and a constitutional culture, as a professor from Illinois has put it, a constitutional culture that could last the ages. And regarding fame, you know, Abraham Lincoln was interested in fame, but listen to what he said when he ran the first time for public office. He said, "Every man is said to have his peculiar ambition. Whether it be true or not, I can say for one that I have no other so great as that of being truly esteemed by my fellow men by rendering myself worthy of their esteem." Madison did not seek the esteem of his fellow man, but he did seek to be worthy, and in that worth, he achieved esteem.
Given Madison's crucial role in the Constitutional Convention and the ratification of the Constitution, was James Madison the most important or the most indispensable of the Founding Fathers?
There were a number of indispensable Founding Fathers. We would not have had the Constitution but for Washington. We would not have had the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution following but for Jefferson's pen. We would not have had the Constitution but for Madison. We would not have had today's Constitution in its strength and coherence without John Marshall. We would not have had the strength of our nation without Alexander Hamilton taking advantage of the Constitution's grant of power to the federal government to create a long-lasting economy. No, there were a number of indispensable men, all the way up through Lincoln and perhaps beyond. Madison was one of them, but he would admit that he was only one and would never have claimed the moniker as father of the Constitution to himself.
Would you call Madison's machinations and stage direction, as you say, the beginning of Madison's career as a politician of sorts?
I think that's a very insightful question. It's difficult to answer, so let's think out loud about that. Madison's beginning as a politician began, of course, in the First Congress. And what did he achieve in the First Congress? He achieved the passage of the Bill of Rights. That's an extraordinary achievement. He persuaded his colleagues to adopt the Bill of Rights for a number of reasons. One, the Federalists had promised that they would do so. And number two, they had better do so soon because the Virginians were considering calling for a second constitutional convention right then and there. Three, he schooled them, as we said in our video, of how loyal the Anti-Federalists were as fighters for independence. They were as patriotic as we Federalists, and we should not leave them out of the structure. Number four, we could formulate the Bill of Rights to make sure that the Constitution's structure and the powers that were granted to the federal government were not compromised. And number five, he admitted, he said, "I think the Anti-Federalists were right. We need a Bill of Rights with the necessary and proper clause being open-ended. We need a Bill of Rights." And so He persuaded them again, if you call this political, by the force of his reasoning. He also did extraordinary preparation work. When he put forward those resolutions that led to the Bill of Rights, he had surveyed all the proposed bills of rights that had emanated from the ratifying conventions. He had looked at all the declarations of rights in the constitutions of the several states, and he had looked far afield in other documents to look at what fundamental rights would be. And he subsumed them all into kind of individual rights for the individuals. He did not, as I say, attack the structure and the powers of the federal government. But he also phrased them in legally enforceable terms. Now, Madison was a man who read and knew law, but never wanted to be a lawyer. But his understanding of what the legal enterprise was acute. So if you think of the Bill of Rights compared to the declarations of rights of the various states, there's no hortatory language. So, for example, in Virginia, something is said, again, I'm paraphrasing, the freedom of the press is essential to a free government, therefore it ought not to be abridged. That kind of language was missing in the Bill of Rights. Bill of Rights said, Congress shall not. The right of the people to be secure in their homes shall be secure, shall be guaranteed. Double jeopardy shall not be permitted. Trial by jury. They're all imperative commands that can be enforced by law. So he made the Bill of Rights not only a place where the anti-federalists could then join in the Constitution. He made it legally enforceable, something that was not just precatory towards the legislature, but something the courts could use to restrain the legislature. So then he became head of Congress, and he did so when he began to change his mind about the federal government's powers. And it's always been debated as to why he changed his mind. He reacted against Hamilton's economic program. And in his reaction, formulated a group of members of Congress that opposed it. There was a compromise between Madison and Jefferson and Hamilton where the program went through. But the Bank of the United States really rankled Madison. And then the Jay Treaty in 1794, where Madison and Jefferson thought that Washington had sold out to the British, really then solidified the party differentiation. So in that sense, Madison didn't become political in the partisan sense by what he had done before. He became political by reaction to Hamilton. And I think his greatest political, in the larger sense of political meaning, things that assist the polis triumphs occurred before this time, before he had become partisan, when he used his powers of persuasion, of coordination with people. I think then that was when he was at the height of his powers.
So to quote the late Justice Scalia in his dissent in Morrison v. Olson, another film from FedSoc Films that you can check out on YouTube, he wrote, "In the dictatorships of the modern world, bills of rights are a dime a dozen. What makes ours work is a governmental structure." Is that essentially a Madisonian view? And was that Madison's, you know, general thinking here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You look at Federalist 10, Federalist 47, Federalist 51. His arguments are crystal clear. You structure the government so it's divided, so that the impetus towards tyranny, the impetus towards factionalization is frustrated. And what does that leave? That leaves only the opportunity to work together, to work for the common good. Knowing that all men are divided between passions for themselves and sympathy and concern for others. When it came to politics, Madison tried to formulate a structure that would contain the passions and leave open opportunity for the sympathetic actions regarding others.
So why do you think law school students should care about James Madison, especially in this, you know, stage manager context of his career?
Just as Breyer, before he announced his retirement, had an interview, and he talked about an unpleasant experience he had at Stanford Law School. He was speaking about the Constitution, and he found the students, as he put it, utterly cynical. And it disturbed him deeply. And this happened only a year or two ago. And if you'll notice, Justice Breyer's latest statements about the court have been quite inspiring in some ways. And he said, we have to have the young people read that document, he said. See that it sets limits, and that those limits are good for us. The reason why, I think he was absolutely right, the reason why we have to take James Madison seriously is that he foresaw that a polity without internal limits is one that can become a tyranny. A polity in which people do not have a sense of self-government, not only self-government in the sense of what the structure is, but self-government in the sense of ruling their own passions, will fail. In this sense, he reflected what John Adams said, who said, a free government is only, a republican government can only be maintained by the virtue of a citizenry, by a virtuous citizenry, I think he said. And so if modern generations lose this sense of restraint, of limits, of concern for one another, and become simply self-regarding factions, beholden to their passions, the constitutional structure that James Madison helped erect will fail. He would have no doubt about that. They'll become just parchment barriers, he'll say. So that's why we need to take him seriously for our own sake, for what he did and the message that he left for us.
What do you think Madison would say, looking at civil society today, especially with the comment on law school students and their, you know, views on the Constitution? Do you think we have an adequate level of virtue to sustain the Republic today?
The answer is obviously no. But virtue is of various types, and we're lacking in most of them.
What is virtue? What does Madison say about virtue in this context?
Virtue is what Aristotle said is the habit of acting rightly, is developing an attitude and an inclination, as St. Thomas would say, to behave in a certain manner as sort of a default position. The woman behind the counter gives you a dollar too much change. You automatically give her back the dollar. You don't have to think and agonize over it. You've developed the habit of acting virtuously. We don't have that now. We don't have that now in our popular culture, in social discourse. And beyond that, what you need on top of that, or maybe emanating from that, is what's called public virtue. That is the virtue to think of when one has power, to think of power as only being vouchsafed to you to use it for the public good. And frankly, I don't think the last few leaders of our country have shown that form of public virtue the way, say, that Truman or Eisenhower, and even those we regard as not successful, such as Jimmy Carter or Gerald Ford, they all had a sense of public virtue. Reagan did. Reagan's opponents, Walter Mondale, did have that sense of public virtue. We don't seem to have that lately. And so I think Justice Breyer is right to be really troubled. Really troubled. And although he's not an originalist, he's been making in his last few years of public statements some very originalist kinds of statements about returning to the source of our polity and the source of our prosperity, namely the Constitution and its limits.
Why do you care about James Madison?
Why do I care about James Madison? Why do I care about my grandfather? It's the same answer. Yeah. He has made my life as a progenitor. He has fathered so much in what I regard as valuable. He has created a helped to create a country in which I prosper, in which it is actually I'm once able to love. Yes, I admire James Madison the same way I admire my grandfather.
So thank you so much, Professor Forte, for joining us today for another episode of the FedSoc Films podcast. Our guest today was Professor David Forte, who was featured in Madison and the Fight for the Constitution, one of the latest productions from FedSoc Films. You can check out the film Madison and the Fight for the Constitution on YouTube, Facebook, or at fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to subscribe for more episodes of the FedSoc Films podcast. If you like this episode, please leave us a review. As always, the Federalist Society doesn't take any positions on the issues discussed. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.